house is up. Julius is up. With Ray and Cap. Caesar was a vampire. Don't make me pull a Sulla. Life of Caesar.
Hey.
I'm here, buddy.
Well, good. Good. I just figured you were getting last minute eggs or something.
Last minute head. it's actually on the can.
just stuck with the first story.
How you doing?
Oh, doing okay.
Having a bit of a meltdown there yesterday, buddy.
just a bit. You know, when I rule this universe, mm-hmm. I'm still going to say hi to the lower people, mm. you know, because that's who I am. In fact, mm. I'm not even going to think of them as lower people. Hey, I do this job, you do that job, but we're, you know, we're basically all the same.
Mm-hmm. So what did Dan Carlin do to you? Tell us all.
No, just, you know, you have laws and you have rules and then you have customs and then you just have basic civility. Mm-hmm. And when someone ignores all of those and tries to run roughshod over you and, you know, to the point where you're not even going to question it, are you just going to take it? That just pisses me off. It just really burns me up and I just can't stand human. I mean, we are all the same. Some of us either have started out in life with better circumstances or whatever. I don't know the differences between humans, but, you know, we're all the same and we should all treat each other with a modicum of respect the way you treat me, modicum. And it just burns my bridges when I see that blatantly not being done.
Look, all I did was ask people to write a poem that said there once was a man called Ray. I'm not the one that said the gay rhymes with Ray. That wasn't my fault. I didn't say write a, you know, like a snarky poems yeah. about Ray. Right. I just said write a poem.
They could have written some nice. No, I think Amanda had the best one. But they were all very good, which meant some of them were painful.
They were all really bad. In fact, I reviewed them all last night again to see who I was going to give the prize to. I decided none of them. They're hopeless.
Right.
None of them were any good.
Okay. Well, let's not zoom over this. It's like you walked up to someone. Look, here's a can of gas. Here's a couple matches. You don't have to do anything if you don't want to, but you can. And if you do and you do it well, there's a reward in it for you, but you don't have to do anything.
Well, listen, I was going to leave this to the end of the show, but now that we're into it, we'll do it up the front. So for those of you who don't know what the hell I'm talking about, on Facebook a couple of days ago, I mentioned that poetry was going to play a role in today's episode and suggested that everyone should have a go at writing a limerick that started there once was a man called Ray. And they were mostly terrible. I really think that most of you don't understand the concept of one in five line anapestic meter. They were all over the place. Yeah. There was no rhythmic consistency there.
Yeah.
But our new obsessive compulsive listener, Martin Darlington.
Yeah, I saw that.
From Qatar. Who has recently discovered the show and claims to have listened to 31 episodes in the last week and sends us about 4 emails a day. Very long emails, Martin.
Yeah, it's full of love.
Which I noticed Ray hasn't bothered to reply to any of them because he's too busy complaining about being picked on by powerful people or his bosses or something. But Martin wrote us this poem. It's not a limerick, but it wins anyway. Here it is.
Yeah.
If Caesar floats your boat at all and history yanks your string, then Ray and Cameron fit the bill. But listen, here's the thing. This ain't no stuffy schooltime show where po-faced teachers rule. These guys will tell it how it was, but in a way that's cool. They like to have a laugh and sometimes that can get quite rude. But if you don't like what they say, just jog on, narky prude. For anyone who has a sense of humour and some style, this show will keep you laughing whilst informing all the while. You may not yet have heard about the town of Cinebum, or how Nicomedes asked JC to his place for some fun, or Labienus, Cicero, Rich Crassus and the rest, and poor old Pompey, still convinced that he alone was best. So many shows that Ray and Cam have put out this last year. With 40 shows now in the can, the end is surely near. But we can stop this awful fate by urging them along to carry Caesar's story far beyond when he was gone. Augustus has to have his day. Mark Antony as well. Of Philippi and Actium, we want to hear them tell. So Cam and Ray, get out your books and prep some more damn shows. Don't make us pull a Sulla or your wives become widows. Round of applause
Darlington. Way too much time on his hand, but
yeah. Flying helicopters around Qatar, apparently. You have plenty of time to listen to podcasts. Well, I'm sorry about your bad day, Ray, but I'm gonna make it better. We're gonna have a good fun couple of hours. Community shout-outs. Dan Jones is a listener of the show. Dan is a muso in the United Kingdom. I've just been reading about the latest allegations in the Westminster sex abuse scandal. You know, there are currently 75 members of parliament and 250 persons of prominence, celebrities, etc., that are caught up in this child rape and torture scandal in the United Kingdom. Way to go, Britain. You're absolutely... Way to go, England. Getting back to Dan Jones, who has nothing to do with that, I should say. Right. Nothing to do at all with sex abuse scandals. Dan's released an EP. It's like all guitars. It's a guitar instrumental. You can find it at danjonesguitar.com. He's got videos on YouTube, danjonesguitar.bandcamp.com. You can listen, but just go to danjonesguitar.com.
Yeah,
very nice guitar-y stuff. He's very talented, and we thank him for listening to the show. A couple more shout-outs. Kevin O'Connor is a patron. And we didn't include him in the patron list. He got missed. Shout out for Kevin O'Connor. We have a Share the Love winner this episode. This is something we haven't done for a while. This is where somebody shares something on Facebook about the show to their friends and followers. This time it's going out to our mate Steve Ellis, comic book genius, writer, artist, Steve, you know, did a good Facebook post this week. I think about our last VIP episode, gave it a big plug. So
nice.
I'd like to
thank you,
Steve. Send us your address in an email to arve@lifeofcaesar.com, and we're going to send you a something, coffee mug maybe.
Yes, something.
The other news before we get into the show, as people on Facebook know, is that. My wife has told me that we're going to the United States at the end of this year.
You talked about it and you thought the pros and the cons. No, she just told you.
Yeah, that's how it works.
Straight up told you. All
right. Yeah. All right. I think we should try and do some stuff together.
I'm sorry. I have to interrupt you. Okay, so everybody, Chrissy's told Cam that he has to come to the States. So what Cam wants to do is take this negative and turn it into a positive.
Yeah, because that's one of my rules in life. I always tell my kids, when shit happens, you say, how do I turn this to my advantage? And what does this enable me to do that I couldn't do previously?
Smart. They're smart.
There's a couple of life hacks for free there, folks.
There you go.
If you want to know more, join my Life Hacks podcast, Cameron's Life Hacks. No, I'm kidding. I don't have one of those. if you want to see Ray and I meet in person for the first time and mud wrestle nude with snakes.
God. Actually, if you could switch out to sharks are the big thing on the East Coast this year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Email us at arve@lifeofcaesar.com. I haven't set up a thing yet, but yeah, so I'm going to come over and obviously Ray and I are going to get together. We might do a bit of a live show. We might do some meet and greets in different parts of the country. We're not going to come to your town just because you think your town is awesome.
Because you're you. You're right, right, right.
We'll probably do something in LA, probably something on the East Coast. Well, at least this is where I'm going to be, whether or not Ray comes with me to all these locations. But I'm probably going to be on the West Coast. I'm going to be on the East Coast, probably New York. I'm going to go probably to Toronto for the Canadians. The Canadians. I'll probably be in Toronto with J. David Markham is up there. So we might get together with old JDM if he can, you know, spare us the time. He's so busy. And I'll be in Utah, so maybe we'll do something in Salt Lake City.
Is pot legal there?
Gay marriage is legal there, much to the consternation of the ruling Mormon elite.
Oh, yeah.
Anywho. Okay. So that's that.
So did... Yeah.
And this is probably, I think, Chrissy's looking at us being there from the 15th of December to the 15th of January. So somewhere in that vicinity, keep your calendar free. The cam is coming. Now, this is assuming I get through customs.
Yeah.
It's always a bit of a dice roll whenever I go to the US. I'm always standing in customs just waiting for them to check my Facebook page or my blog or something and go, oh, it's you.
Oh.
Oh, right. Let me introduce you to Gitmo.
Gitmo Jr. We have one here in the airport. It's next to the gift shop. Do you bring a boomerang with you? Maybe that's it. Do you bring, I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's a dangerous weapon in my hands, a boomerang, man. So let's get on with episode whatever the hell this is. 40.
40? 40,
oh,
wow.
Oh, 40. Wow. So it is autumn of 46 BCE at the opening of our episode. And I'm going to start it all by saying it's all Quintus Cassius Longinus's fault.
Son of a, yes, it is, absolutely. Caesar's in Rome. He's when he's not, you know, partying and doing triumphs, even though he works through those. This man is working like crazy. He is trying to, I don't know, put a square deal out there for everybody. He's improving the lives of many people. He's getting people out of town because it's overpopulated. He's trying to improve the infrastructure of Rome. He's shipping people out. He is bringing a lot of good to a lot of Rome. The problem is, and Cam has said this a billion times, the rules and the laws that he is passing, they're good ones, but they're all coming from one man. They're coming from Caesar, and they're coming from just him. There's no debate. There's no discussion. There's nothing in the Senate. Everybody in the Senate is just a mouthpiece or rubber stamp. So he's doing good works, and it would be nice if he could live forever, but the people want the senators want the republic back. So even though he's doing a lot of good work, it's starting to rub people the wrong way. And he's got one eye out to Spain, and he's hoping the few remaining people of the Pompeians are going to be able to be handled by the local legates. But it's probably not going to turn out that way, and he's going to have to get his ass up again and go, my God, I don't know how many times this has been, and go to Spain and handle it himself. Because even though he's a very very gifted man, everybody around him seems to be so limited, so he's got to do so much by himself. And this is probably just one more thing he's going to have to get up and handle and, you know, be the man on the spot to make sure everything turns out the way it's supposed to.
I'm going to talk a little bit later on about leadership and bringing up leaders behind you. You know, it's a common trend in these stories, you know, whether it's Caesar or Alexander or Napoleon, or, you know, I don't know. I was going to say Hitler.
He just shouted at everybody.
You know, just, you know, leaving aside Hitler, these brilliant leaders and it always seems like they need to be on the spot. I was going to say, like Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, you see a similar thing. Probably see the same thing when Rupert Murdoch dies. You know, these visionaries who are able to accomplish amazing, incomprehensible feats, but if they're not there, shit tends to go badly. For some reason, they don't seem to be able to hire or find or train people of, you know, equivalent capability. Anyway, I'll talk about this later. I want to stick with Spain. So Quintus Cassius Longinus.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked about him before, I think back in episode 35, that is.
Right.
Caesar made him the governor of further Spain after Caesar had been over there and defeated Afranius and Petreius. But but this Longinus, or Cassius as he tends to be referred to, it was a bit of a fuck-up. He was just greedy and a complete dick, just an oppressive.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No.
I was just going to say, you can be a jerk or you can be a greedy fuck, but he's a greedy fucking jerk. Oh my God, this guy would steal from people. His own people hated him. The locals hated him. And so pretty soon he's got to get on a ship and get the fuck out of town because he has screwed up what should have been a pretty cushy job. You just keep further Spain calm because eventually the civil war is going to die out because they just don't have enough people going. But he fucks up so completely that it becomes a trouble spot, and it becomes a magnet for all the few Pompeians who are left, and they're all going to converge there because there's a spot of unhappiness in Caesar's world that they can exploit. He's just really amazing at being an ass. He pissed me off, and I only read about him for a little bit.
So I wonder why Caesar would have given him this position in the first place. I mean, if the guy was damaged goods, if he was a psychopath, maybe Caesar should have known that and gone, you know what, it's probably not a good idea to put this guy in charge.
But he's so busy all the time. Good guy. Yeah, you know, I agree with you. He should just, how can he keep everything at the forefront of his mind?
Caesar?
Yeah, that's what I meant. Yeah.
Well, I mean, when you're appointing people as governors, you know,
decide right there.
Yeah, but I think, and this comes across a lot during the Civil War, is Caesar's options are limited.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a vast number of the experienced, capable men have gone with Pompey.
Right.
Caesar's left with what he's left with. He doesn't have a huge selection of top class guys to put in these positions of power, and consequently, the ones he does tend to be fuck ups. Mark Antony, this guy, etc.
Yeah.
Anyway, so as you say, he we talked about this back in episode 35. Caesar had sent Cassius instructions to pass into Africa to help him with the African campaign. But instead, Cassius tried to, like, just do a runner and tried to escape Spain. His ship was wrecked in a storm and he drowned.
God's will.
So Caesar's still got legates there, and he's hoping the legates are going to be able to deal with Pompey's sons, Cneius and Sextus, who are running the Pompeian camp now in Spain. And I want to talk about them a little bit in detail.
Yeah.
Cneius is the older of the two. He's about 30 years old at this stage, also known in the histories as Pompey the Younger.
Mm-hmm.
He had gone with his daddy, Big Daddy-O, to the east at the beginning of the Civil War. But apart from that, as far as I can tell, had no previous military experience. You know, Pompey wasn't really doing anything for the previous 10 years. I don't think he hadn't been in Gaul with Caesar or anything like that. So fairly untried apart from, you know, the Civil War, and even in the Civil War, Pompey had, you know, a number of good generals in his camp, Labienus, etc. So I don't know that Pompey the Younger had much experience, but now he's going up against fucking Caesar.
But he's got one thing going for him that, I mean, we could talk about this later, we have to do it now, but he was a fucking brute that applied tactics that maybe if his father had applied, I don't know if the Senate would have let him do that, but with the numbers that Pompey Sr. had, he might have been able to fare better against Caesar. But Cneius, as I like to call him, is just a Hannibal, if you will. He's just a monster in a robe, and he's going to slaughter so many people of his own people that it's just amazing. Everybody was following him mostly out of fear, certainly not respect like they did for his father.
Yeah, well, let's remember that he's got Labienus in his camp, and Labienus has been brutal all the
pretty
way
brutal,
along. So, you know, he's probably exerting a strong influence. That's Cneius. Then we've got Sextus. He's about 22 at this stage. He's the younger brother. He was actually one of the witnesses to his father's execution in Egypt. He was on
that's
the
boat. Right.
Hadn't taken part in the civil war up to this point. And I got to wondering what happened to Sextus and Pompey. So imagine, let's go back to when Pompey's had his throat cut on the shores of Egypt. His right. wife and Sextus and some of his other kids are in the boat. What happens next? You're on a boat. You see your husband, your father, get his throat cut.
Yeah.
Up until recently, the most powerful man in the world.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do next? Do you go, shit, let's turn the boat around and go somewhere else? Do you...
I vote for that one.
Disembark and go, we don't know that guy. Who is that guy? Like, never seen him before in my life. And I couldn't really find anything in any of my sources about what happened next. Although, after Caesar is given Pompey's head and ashes and signet ring, he apparently gives them to Pompey's wife, Cornelia. I'm not sure if she was in Egypt or if he sent them to her at Rome. But eventually, she returned to Rome, spent the rest of her life in Pompey's estates in Italy.
Damn.
But I don't know what Sextus did immediately after that. It would have been a little bit nerve-wracking, I imagine. But anyway, he ends up going to Rome too and looking after her, I think, and his mother until he ends up going to Spain. Now, both Gnaeus and Sextus are sons by Pompey's third wife, Mucia mm-hmm. Tertia.
Right.
Now, I think Cornelia was his fifth wife, because after Mucia Tertia was Caesar's daughter, and then after Caesar's daughter was Cornelia. Now, Mucia was, you know who her first husband was?
Oh, God.
No, it wasn't it's God. Right. No.
No, it's right there. Who was it? It's killing me.
Gaius Marius the Younger.
That's right, yes.
Son of the Gaius Marius.
Right.
So he committed suicide in 82 BCE after his defeat by Sulla and 4 years after his father died of maybe natural causes. Sulla then, as dictator, needs to secure Pompey's loyalty, and to do that he arranges his marriage to Mucia around 79 BCE. And she had three kids, the two boys and a daughter, and had the misfortune to outlive all three.
Damn.
So between 76 and 61 BC, so he marries her in 79, then he spends, you know, the next, well, seven years away from Rome, campaigning in Hispania against Sertorius. Mm-hmm. He's fighting the pirates in the Mediterranean, and then he goes and finds Mithridates.
Yeah.
He gets back in 61, Pompey this is, divorces her.
Mm.
Mm. His reasons?
Unkind. No, what?
According to Cicero's correspondence, he accused her of adultery. Who was she supposedly having an affair with?
Labienus.
Well, you know, there is that version of the story.
Oh, Caesar.
Caesar is the other story. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe both.
Maybe.
Now, you know, so I've got on my notes. So here we have the first example of sons of a woman that Caesar slept with who wanted him dead. Not the last example.
No. But,
so these guys apparently don't like Caesar banging their mum. They have a club. They have a club in Rome. It's called the Caesar Banged My Mum Club. They all meet around and go, I'm gonna fucking kill that guy. He banged your mum, he banged my mum too.
You're not gonna kill him. I'm gonna kill him.
That fucking asshole banged my mum. In front of me too. Like, we don't have soundproofing in our villa. It's just like a curtain around the bed and I can hear him going
at it.
It's
not enough.
Yeah.
It's not enough. but I have to interject real quick. When I was very young, probably, I don't know, 10, 11 or whatever.
Is this a story about somebody banging your mum in front of you? Because if it is,
you're
I don't want to know.
The story for
Were you in the House of Lords? No, what?
You're, you're really in the story. No, but I was reading, I was getting into Caesar's, getting into Roman history, and it finally dawned on me what they meant by cuckolding. Not only would Caesar have an affair with someone's wife, that was just something to do on a Wednesday. But what he would do was he would wait for the right moment and break up with her, and then she would be moping around the house and drooping and all this stuff. The husband's like, "What the hell's wrong with you?" You know, and she couldn't tell, or maybe she did, and made the house situation worse. But here I'm like a 10 or 11 little boy, and I'm like, "Oh my God, these people are fucking each other's wives, and they're hurting, and they're breaking their hearts," and it just really warped me as a child. So not only is he banging everybody, but even his breakup was calculated for effect to get back at a political enemy. And, you know, he just did that over and over and over again. And that just warped the hell out of me as a child, which is why I am the way I am today.
Yeah, I don't think that's the definition of cuckolding, though, man.
No, but that's what I got out of it as a kid. You know, I'm just saying, I just thought it was sex. But there was more to it. There was psychological warfare through your wife's vagina. I mean, it was just, oh my God, that's just really, really mean. You shouldn't do that.
The wives were fucking Caesar while their husbands were in the room. And she's like, look.
This is how you do it.
You know this guy, you know who this is? You see the wreath around his head, the laurel crown? Yeah.
Oh, the other head. Yeah.
Yeah. But
anyway, I'm
so
sorry.
It might have been Caesar, it might have been Labienus, but either way, I mean, Pompey ends up obviously friends after this with Caesar. They form the triumvirate, colleagues anyway, if not friends. He also has Labienus join his roving band of marauders. So apparently he didn't really care. I mean, I think it was often adultery, I think, in ancient Rome was just an excuse. It was your get out of jail free card if you wanted to get rid of someone and pick up with someone younger, in this case, Caesar's daughter. So getting back to Spain. So Caesar thinks the legates are going to deal with it, but by about November 46, he realizes he has to take charge.
Yeah.
And this is where I had all my notes about leadership and Bill Gates and Steve Jobs. And, you know, we've talked about this before, I think, but there's a big difference between leaders and managers. And I think that's one of the big problems in the world today. Right. Is our organizational cultures, whether they're business or governmental or religious, they tend to breed and support managers, but we don't have leaders. And this comes back to the question, are leaders born or can you be trained to be a leader?
Right.
You know, a leader has a sense of vision, a sense of confidence. People want to follow them. They want to be led by them. They want to be part of what they're doing because it's inspiring. It's exciting. They think there's a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow if they go with these people. So, and you find this consistently when you read these histories of these, you know, outstanding individuals that they quite often struggle to find people to follow them. I mean, and we can take contemporary guys as well. So Bill Gates retires as CEO of Microsoft. He's replaced by Steve Ballmer. Steve, been around the business since pretty much day one. Very capable guy in many respects. As a CEO, you're a bit of a fuck-up. I mean, by all accounts, ends up getting squeezed out by Bill Gates and the board a year or so ago. The new guy that they've replaced him with, Nutella, you know, doesn't look like he's much better. Steve Jobs dies. Tim Cook, very capable COO of Apple, but unimpressive in many ways. You know, in the last, four years now, I think, since Steve died, Apple hasn't really done very much exciting. iWatch has been a bit of a dud. You know, it's difficult, apparently, for these great leaders to teach their craft to the people that are closest to them and the most capable people closest to them. You know, you look at even with Caesar with Labienus. Okay, Labienus leaves him. Labienus is probably the most capable of his commanders.
Right.
But is a complete, I mean, a lunatic, psychopath.
Yeah.
So why do you think that is, Ray? Why is it hard to, like, and I struggle this with you. Like, I've been trying to teach you for the last 18 months.
Yeah.
And, you know,
you failed miserably.
It's not working.
No. This is our last show. The only stab I could possibly take at that is I think very quickly when you have someone who just walks into a room and they know themselves and they know exactly what they want to do and they exude that kind of confidence, because that's such a small percentage of the population, I think everybody else just goes into a certain mode. Okay, here's someone who knows what's going on. They'll make much better decisions than I will. I'm just going to go into follow the leader mode. And I think people just get really good, people around Caesar get really good at carrying out orders. They're not going to come up with anything. They're not going to deviate from what he said or what he wrote down. They're just really good. They're just really good colonels getting all stuff done. And I think the idea of thinking outside the box, problem solving, bringing something new, just as a muscle that just doesn't get used and it gets weaker over time because they're just so used to taking orders. And Caesar, like so many other people like him, just suck the air out of the room and they just get good at following. And I think that develops very quickly. And then there's no even possibility of becoming their own person until that person's dead or until they've left the room or they've left, you know, being in charge of everything. That's the best answer I can give you.
Yeah, I think you're onto it there. I think that these sorts of people, again, and whether it's in ancient times or modern times, to be a great leader, you have to be an independent thinker. But those people tend not to want to have independent thinkers around them.
Right. Exactly.
Because those people are going to challenge their authority and they don't want that. They want people that will just do what they tell them to do and be good executors of orders rather than, you know, brilliant independent thinkers. So the other independent thinkers of that time don't get to rise through the organization. They go off and become, you know, something else. They go do something else with their lives.
Yeah.
And so when that leader dies or retires, they're left with sycophants and order takers.
Right.
Who then fuck it up. And everything that they've built just crumbles. But as we'll see when we finish this series, if we go on and do Augustus.
Right.
Magically somehow.
Yeah.
This young kid who really had very little time with Caesar at all turns out to be perhaps, you know, a better leader than even his adopted uncle was.
Right. And I'm going to guess it's something you were saying earlier, the difference between a leader and a manager. A leader leads and you just do whatever he says, whatever she says, and everything's as good as it's going to get. Whereas a manager brings out the best of everybody. And it's like, I trust you to handle this. I can't handle this. You go handle that and handle it any way you want. But you handle that. And I'll just steer the ship in a general sense. And that's me guessing what you would say that a manager is. But we're going to find out. And I really hope that we do go on to Augustus. I know you and I have been talking about this over and over again. We're not sure what to do next. And we've had so much fun with Caesar. But Augustus literally was someone who was a sickly kid who learned to deal with being sickly. He wasn't a military thinker. He learned military tactics. And he is the kind of person I think you're talking about. He literally grabs himself by the bootstraps, recognizes all of his weaknesses and improves upon them. And he brings people into the fold and he includes everybody in the Senate. And so it's much more, what the hell am I thinking? It's a lot more lies and a lot more politics involved as opposed to just Caesar saying, do what I say. But Augustus becomes very good at that and he is seen as a leader because he brings everybody together and everybody thinks they're involved when really, in a lot of ways, he's still setting the overall tone, whereas Caesar was just blatant about it. And that's just one of the things I really like about Augustus. He just finds out who he is, finds out his weaknesses and works on them, and he doesn't make excuses for him. He tries to improve himself for the rest of his life, and he gets really good at it.
Well, I'd love, you know, part of me would like to go into Augustus, and I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah. It's up in the air.
Yeah, we'll see. Yeah. I mean, it really comes down to you, listeners. If you want us to do Augustus, vote Augustus.
Yeah.
Hashtag vote Augustus.
There you go.
Anyway, so.
Where were we?
Caesar leaves Rome.
Caesar
leaves Rome, November 46. He leaves Rome in charge of Lepidus, who's the master of horse at this stage, Mark Antony's old job. He also leaves behind 8 prefects, but in reality, much of the day-to-day management is being handled by Caesar's 2 right-hand men, Gaius Oppius and Lucius Cornelius Balbus.
Yes.
They're his assistants.
Exactly. And they've been kind of running things for him. They've been running his life and his works for a while. And it's not like Caesar picked the top 10 senators or the top 50 senators or whatever. No, again, they're just guys who show up whenever there's Senate's in session. These two guys and the master of the horse, Lepidus, they're just running everything. And again, it's been years since these senators have been able to make a decision. And Caesar's like, I haven't got time to worry about your feelings right now. You guys are in charge. I got to go handle this, and then we'll see what's what. But again, the Senate is not operating like it did before Caesar crossed the Rubicon.
And these two guys were apparently two of the guys that dined with Caesar on the night he crossed the Rubicon, along with Mark Antony and I think Hirtius. Balbus was an interesting guy. I sort of drilled down in the bios of these guys. Balbus was actually born in Spain.
Comes a long way.
Not a Roman, but here he is running Rome. So imagine how the bony are taking that right now.
Yeah.
Guy he's not a bony, he's not a patrician, he's not even a fucking Roman, and he's running Rome. Well, not a natural born Roman anyway.
Right.
So
not a pleb. Yeah, yeah.
Born in Spain, served in Hispania under Pompey against Sertorius. For his services, Pompey confers Roman citizenship upon him and his family.
Nice.
Then he goes back to Rome with Pompey in 71 for a long time as one of his best friends. Then, as a result of, you know, sort of inner circle stuff, he becomes good friends with Caesar. And they actually say that it was his personal friendships with Pompey and Caesar that was instrumental in the formation of the first triumvirate. He was the guy that was like, hey, you know what? You know what you should do? Like, call me fucking crazy, but let me run this up the flagpole for a minute. What if, just hear me out.
Put the sword down.
What if the two of you and, let's say, Marcus Licinius Crassus came together and shared power amongst the three of you? I know, it's a crazy idea. What would we call it? Well, there's three of you. You're very virile, all of you. Let's call it the triumvirate. So he was also the chief financier in Rome. Mm-hmm. So he's like the head banker, man. He's doling out the cash. Very powerful dude for a non-Roman. Caesar then makes him chief engineer when Caesar's propraetor in Hispania in 61.
Right.
And then when he goes to Gaul, he takes Balbus with him. Now, when the Civil War comes along, he crosses the Rubicon with Caesar. But then when the Civil War happens, he stays neutral, doesn't take a side, friends with both of these guys, a bit like Cicero.
Right.
But acts as Caesar's private agent while Caesar's away from Rome. So, you know, Caesar's writing him a letter, buy me this, buy me that, sell. He's like, yep, no worries. And obviously earning an income from doing that, it makes makes a shitload of cash. During the Civil War, as we've talked about before, the economy was fucked. Price, you know, is typical of a wartime economy. Everyone's trying to pull their cash out. Real estate property prices are dropping. Caesar's buying up shit and Balbus is profiteering from that.
He's got his hands in it,
So this is the guy who's now running Rome, and as we'll see in coming episodes, he also plays a fairly tragic role in Caesar's assassination. But after Caesar's assassination, not to jump the gun, but he becomes close to Octavian and actually becomes the first non-Italian to become consul. So this guy, we should do that. Our next series should be the history of Balbus, although there's not much written about him, obviously. But like incredible life and career this guy had. The
starts
first non-Roman to become a consul.
That's amazing. Now, just like you were saying, I mean, this guy's obviously good at logistics. He's good at finance. He's good at engineering. I'm not sure what kind of warrior, but he could take orders. And so here's a very diverse, developed guy. But because he's not Roman, because he was born in Spain, he can only go so far. He's doing really well. But that's definitely the kind of person that Caesar needs, no matter where the hell he's born, to help him run things, because Rome is just too huge for any one person, no matter how talented, no matter how much he works to run it. And so Caesar could have used about 30 of him, but he didn't have him, so he just did the best he could.
And he's obviously a man of principle and integrity. Like, he doesn't pick a side in the Civil War.
Right.
And gets away with that.
Because they probably respect him about it. Yeah. Yeah.
He's probably respected by both Pompey and Caesar. And he says, look, guys, I love you both. I'm not going to pick a side. Cicero was close to both of them as well, but he ended up, picking a side.
Yeah.
Balbus says, look, guys, I'm not going to pick a side. Is that okay? Just fucking deal with that.
I'll be here when y'all finish.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And manages to survive the whole thing and go on, survives the assassination, like close to Caesar. And still, we'll talk after, during sort of the Ides episodes about, this question about Mark Antony, and should they kill him, should they not kill him? What about Balbus? Right. I mean, he wasn't a military guy, but obviously one of the most powerful guys, very well connected, but survives that, goes on, becomes consul. Incredible story. Yeah.
Yeah.
Obviously a very good operator.
Yeah.
So Caesar arrives in Spain in about 4 weeks, takes a boat, goes around Corsica.
Yeah.
Along the way, not only is he conducting business, but he composes a poem.
Sure, why not?
Called The Iter, a.k.a. The Journey.
Yeah.
Now, we don't really know what it was about, although about his journey, I guess.
Yeah.
It wasn't the first time he'd written poetry. He wrote poems for the pirates when he was captured by them, apparently. Used to entertain the pirates by reading poetry. and then as a youth, he composed a poem about Hercules, which later on Augustus banned, so can't have been good. None of his poetry has survived, and that may be a good thing, because Tacitus considered their loss a happy accident for the dictator's literary reputation. Tacitus wrote, "Caesar and Brutus wrote poems too, and put them in their friends' libraries. They were no better than Cicero, but have been more lucky, for their poetry is less known."
Ah.
Bit of a backhanded slap there.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, Caesar's good at everything else. Why wouldn't he be good at poetry? But hey, you never know. We can't, no one can do everything. But I just think it's amazing. So he's literally on the waves, flying to further Spain, not Spain, further Spain. He's getting there in record time. And I would be like, okay, I got to deal with this. Well, how should I deal with this? And when I get back, I got to finish. I got all these people to reward. And what am I going to do for the next 20 years? No. He's sitting there writing letters. He's sitting there writing poetry. I mean, the guy is like a working vacation. He is just doing things probably just to keep his mind loose. Who knows? But the idea of just sitting there writing poetry as he's about to go, hopefully fight the last battle of the Civil War. I just think it's amazing and a testament to his massive, just, I don't know, balls or what, I don't know. I just think it's amazing that he was just able to do that and then deal with that once he got there. He was very good at compartmentalizing.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I couldn't talk.
Yeah, well, extremely high-performing people can do multiple things simultaneously, which is why I wrote a poem for you, Ray.
Shit. Well done. I got to brace myself. Okay.
There once was a man called Ray.
Uh-huh.
Who had no personality. Then along came this show. And his juices did flow, but now they say Ray is so gay. In the poems.
I'm bi, but go ahead. Oh, is that it?
Oh, that's good. Yeah, that's it.
Okay.
So he gets to further Spain. Come on, personality. That was pretty good.
That was good. I enjoyed that.
Yeah. The rest of it wasn't that good, but that was good. Gnaeus has 13 legions. Getting back to this thing. Gnaeus has 13 legions as well as auxiliaries. JC has only 8 legions, just 2 of which are veterans. He's got the 5th Alaudae and the 10th minus its time expired men, the guys that have gone into retirement, and Caesar's placed in cities all around Transalpine Gaul and Cisalpine Gaul and further Italy.
Yeah.
And he's also got some newer legions, I think, the 3 Gallica and the 6 Ferrata And he's also going to have some recruits that have been put together by his legates, etc., in Hispania.
Yeah, I just find it so ironic that he's been so busy working so hard, disbanding legions. They've been with him for years. They're tired. They just want their money. They want their plot of land, whatever, you know. And he's been working so hard to get rid of them that when he does need them for an emergency, he's down to 8 legions. Only 2 are semi-veteran. The rest aren't. And he's going up against 13 legions. And I'm sure all of them are not veterans, but they have more veterans than he does. So he's going there and he might be freaking Caesar, but he's already under the gun. He's already the underdog, even though it's him, because they've already got the territory. They've got more men. And this is something that Caesar's been dealing with almost his entire military career, always having less than what the enemy does and having to use his charm and wits to make up the difference.
Just like you, Ray.
Exactly.
Yeah, so, yeah, but he didn't have much choice. I mean,
Well,
his guys that he's placed into retirement, I mean, they'd done their time. They were getting pissy.
Yeah.
They were, mutinying. Is that the word?
Yeah, mutineers.
Mutinous. He had to do something with them. I mean,
I don't blame him. I'm just saying it's just his working so hard didn't leave him with the men he needed. But again, he's going to go, well, you know what? I've been winging it for 20-something years. I'll just go wing it in Spain.
Yeah.
What's the worst thing that could possibly happen?
Yeah. Now, he also called for his great-nephew Octavian to join him, but due to health concerns, Octavian only gets there at the conclusion of the campaign. Now, I call bullshit on that.
Yeah, he's smart to show up at the end. Oh, Uncle, I'm on my way. And he gets there at the end after it's all done.
Yeah, because,
that's what I would do.
What happens if Uncle Caesar gets killed?
Yeah.
You don't want to be too close to the scene of the crime. So, yeah, Octavian plays his cards pretty cleverly here, as he does for the rest of his life. Even at this stage, I don't know if it's his mother or it's him calling the shots here, but somebody's keeping him at a safe distance.
Yeah. And you're probably going to go into detail this, but I absolutely love the conundrum the senators are in. They're like, okay, this is almost about to be over. Caesar's not showing doesn't seem like he's bringing the Senate back the way it was, Rome back the way it was. So if Caesar wins, we will have a nice master who keeps saying he's not going to be like Sulla and he's not going to kill anybody. But if he loses, he's going to lose to Cneius. And those people who know Cneius well know that he's pretty much a brute with a sword, and if he wins and he comes in and rules Rome, blood will flow and he will be like Sulla, just not as pretty. And so these guys are really stuck. Do we want the nice master, or do we want a brute over us? So it's for them, it's like a no-win situation, but they have to somehow prepare for whatever happens in further Spain, even though they have no control over it whatsoever.
And I wonder why they had this opinion of him, because as I said earlier, he'd done nothing before this, but maybe he was just, one of these rich, snotty, upper-class twits who was running around Rome just, pissing on poor people in the street and laughing and, beating up hookers and stuff like that. Typical private school boy, right?
Well, are you going to read the part about Cassius? Because obviously there was a reputation that he had earned somewhere along the way. I don't want to mess that up, but I'm just...
You read it, right? Throw you this one.
In 45, in January 45 BCE, Cassius, the brother-in-law of Brutus, who's writing, everybody's trying to keep in touch, trying to figure out what's going on. Brutus writes, Cassius writes to Cicero, and they're talking about Cneius. He's like, oh my God, are we going to get stuck with Caesar, who's nice, but who's going to rule us? Or are we going to get stuck with Cneius? And he writes, I am afraid he will repay our wit, and because they used to make a lot of jokes about him, with the sword in a peasant fashion. So obviously, whether it's true or not, and I think it is true, Cassius either has a temper or he's got anger issues or whatever, because he's going to end up killing a lot of people that are on his side or neutral in the next couple of months. And he just did seem to be a brute, and it's best for everybody that he's still, that Caesar's probably going to take the day. It's going to take him a while, but it's probably a good thing that Caesar's going to are going to win at the end of this.
See, I threw you a bone and you fucked it up. You didn't even read You didn't even read the full quote.
I did the Cliff Note version.
Yeah, you did the Cliff Note version of two lines. Now, to return to matters affecting the Republic, report what's happening in Spain. I am really worried by this and would rather stick with the old Clement master than have a new and cruel one. You know how fatuous Gnaeus is. You know how he mistakes cruelty for courage and how he thinks we always mock him. I'm afraid he'll repay our wit with the sword in peasant fashion. He mistakes cruelty for courage and thinks we always mock him.
So what does that tell you right there?
That he's a psychopath, this guy. Like
he's got a chip on his shoulder.
They can see it. And even Cassius, who, you know, a year from now is going to stick a fucking dagger in Caesar's chest. Even at this stage, he's saying, I'd rather stick with Caesar than get this young Pompey kid.
Right. That's saying something.
Yeah. All right, so I want to read from the commentaries now. So the Spanish commentaries...
suck.
Not the best of the commentaries, but, you know, I want to read from them because there's a lot of brutal stuff in here, if nothing else.
Yes.
Now, we don't know who wrote them, as usual, after Book 7, but Suetonius suggests, again, it was either Hirtius or maybe Gaius Oppius, I mentioned earlier. So Caesar arrives in Spain on the southern end of Spain, as you say, further Spain, modern Andalusia, if you're looking at a map. He finds out that the enemy are besieging the town of Ulia, which is the only important community that has actually stayed loyal to Caesar. And here's what the commentaries say. Young Gnaeus Pompey himself was employed in the siege of Ulia, which had now lasted some months. Notice of Caesar's arrival having been received, messengers having passed Pompey's guards came to him from that town and besought him to send relief as soon as possible. Caesar, knowing that this people had deserved very well of the Romans, detached about 9 o'clock at night 11 cohorts with a like number of horse under the command of L. Julius Pachycus, a man known in that province and also well acquainted with it. When he arrived at Pompey's quarter, a dreadful tempest arising, attended with a violent wind. I had some violent wind earlier today, but good thing this isn't scratch and sniff podcasting. So great a darkness ensued that you could scarcely have distinguished even the person next to you. This accident proved of great advantage to Pachycus, for being arrived at Pompey's camp, he ordered the cavalry to advance two by two and march directly through the enemy's quarters to the town.
Wow.
One of their guards, calling to know who passed, one of our troopers bade him be silent, for they were just then endeavouring by stealth to approach the wall in order to get possession of the town. And partly by this answer, partly by favour of the tempest, the sentinels were prevented from examining things diligently. When they reached the gates, upon a signal being given, they were admitted, and both horse and foot raised a loud shout. After leaving some troops to guard the town, sallied in a body upon the enemy's camp. This came upon them so unexpectedly that the greater number of the men in the camps thought that they were captured. How's that for balls? They just march through the enemy camp.
Yeah, yeah.
And when the guy goes, who goes there? They go, shut up.
Yeah.
Oh, fuck. All right.
Sorry, sir. Yeah.
I love that.
So to translate that, so Caesar's able to slip some men into Ulia to help defend it, but the rest of the men are able to use the storm, the wind, whatever, and turn on the sleeping Pompeians who are sleeping around who are going to be, you know, sieging the next day and already strike a blow. So again, using this other man, using the storm, they're able to start off really well, get some extra men in there, and then also hit at those who have been attacking the town. So it's a good start for Caesar. Score 1-0.
Yeah. Now Caesar decides that he's going to try and draw Pompey's troops away from Ulia. So Caesar goes to the capital of this province, which is Cordoba. It's being defended by Sextus. And Caesar starts attacking it. So Sextus calls for support from Gnaeus, his big brother. And right. Naius, you know, agrees and draws the main army away from Ulia. He comes over, he starts harassing Caesar, but doesn't get into a pitched battle.
Yeah.
You know, Caesar obviously is pretty confident that he can take these young women. He's like, you know, kicked your dad's ass. Your dad, apart from me, was the greatest general in Rome. Whipped his ass against all odds. How can I just stand and walk away? Sorry.
He survived 10 years in Gaul. So, yeah, Caesar's not really worried. And what he's trying to do is bring on a battle, and Cunaeus is smart enough to harass but not commit everything he's got, because he knows if he does lose, it's going to be all or nothing. So he's harassing, but he's smart enough to keep the soldiers back, and Caesar's trying to draw him in, but it's not working.
Yeah. So Caesar decides that this city is too strong to take, and he lays siege to a smaller town of Ategua.
Right.
Naius follows, still avoids a direct confrontation. And then Caesar starts building siege works. And and so, you know, as you would if you're a citizen of Ategua and you see these siege engines being built, you go,
oh, shit.
Let's give up. Fuck this shit.
Right. And I just think, sorry, go ahead.
After you.
I just think it's amazing now, just to make clear, so everybody, because reading this was really, really painful. I think I read it backwards and it made more sense. But anyway, all the stuff that we're talking about is going to take months. Caesar gets there, I think, in late November or December, something like that. And all this is going to take a couple of months. And during this time, Cam and I are going to give you as much detail as we can. But there's constantly betrayals. There's ambushes. There's small groups of people being slaughtered. There's civilians being slaughtered if their loyalty is questioned. So all during this is the kind of ugly fighting in some ways that Caesar didn't have to deal with before. And he's going to lose more men here than he does at Pharsalus. And so he's got a lot of green troops, and they're going to pay the price because he can't be everywhere at once. But there's a lot of brutal stuff going on. There's a lot of betrayal. There's a lot of people switching sides, and people are going to be killed outright. And we're going to get into all that later. But as this goes on, just keep in mind, we don't really know the exact dates. We don't know, did this take a day? Did it take a couple of days? Because a lot of that stuff was left out, or it was so badly written, it didn't make any sense in the first place. So I just wanted to throw that out there to everybody.
Yeah. So,
you mean mess up your flow?
Yeah. You know, I'm used to it. That's cool.
Sorry.
How's that limoncello going?
It's pretty good.
Pretty good.
Yeah.
So Caesar's building siege works in Ategua. And the people want to surrender. So the commander of the Pompeian garrison rounds up everyone suspected of wanting to surrender, and has them and their families killed. The commentary says, toward the evening of the same day, the fight as usual was renewed before the walls, and the enemy, having thrown many darts and a great quantity of fire from the battlements, proceeded afterward to an action of unexampled cruelty and barbarity. For in the very sight of our troops, they fell to murdering the citizens and tumbling them headlong from the walls. As is usual among barbarians, no parallel to this is to be found in the memory of man.
Damn. Yeah. Oh, and I'm sorry, I just got to do this real quick. And one more criticism of this writing. At least five times, I shit you not, the writer puts, and at 9 o'clock at night, and it was like that was the only time anything happened. He didn't say 10 o'clock or 8 o'clock. He said 9 o'clock at night at least five times, and it drove me crazy, which makes me think he was just sitting down and writing a good story from his memories. But who knows?
That's when Caesar liked to do shit, man. He was a night owl.
he's a nighter. All right.
9 o'clock, all right. Anyway, so even though the citizens were slaughtered and thrown off the walls, they end up surrendering on the 19th of February in 45. I mean, that siege, again, as you said, we don't know when it started, but it probably went on for at least a month or so.
Yeah.
More communities start to defect to Caesar. There are desertions from the Pompeian legions, and The commentaries have some of these stories. This is a good one. He writes, the next day, Tullius, a lieutenant general, accompanied by C. Antonius of Lusitania, came to Caesar and addressed him to this effect. Would to heaven I had been one of your soldiers rather than a follower of C. Pompey, and given those proofs of valor and constancy in obtaining victories for you rather than in suffering for him. The only advantage we reap from following his banners are wretched applauses, being reduced to the condition of indigent citizens, and by the melancholy fate of our country ranked among its enemies, we, who having never shared with Pompey his good fortune, yet find ourselves involved in his disgrace. And after sustaining the attack of so many armed legions, employing ourselves day and night in the works of defence, exposed to the darts and swords of our fellow citizens, vanquished, deserted by Pompey, and compelled to give way to the superior valour of your troops, find ourselves at last obliged to have recourse to your clemency, and implore that you will not show yourselves less placable to fellow citizens than you have so often been to foreign nations. I shall, said Caesar, prove myself the same to fellow citizens as I have been to conquered nations.
Yay. And again, that clemency is just paying off for Caesar because, you know, you'd rather go someone who will spare you than someone who will kill you if you just say the wrong thing. And that's going to happen. Some of the people mentioned to Cneius that they say something like when they tell him how many people have died, or word starts spreading that people are dying, he literally has some of those people killed. He wants everybody to keep their mouth shut. Look, we win every engagement. We win every battle. That's what you say, even if we don't win. He's really starting to panic. People are coming over, and he is just overreacting even more and more as the days go by because he's terrified because he probably knows what's coming.
Yeah. But the brutality wasn't all on one side.
Right.
The commentaries go on. At the same time, the standard bearer of the 1st Legion came over to our camp and reported that the day when the skirmish happened between the horse, no less than 35 of his company fell. But it was not allowed. He was not allowed to mention it in Pompey's camp, or so much as own the loss of one man. A slave whose master was in Caesar's camp and who had left his wife and son in the city cut his master's throat and deceived the guards, escaped privately to Pompey's camp, whence by means of a bullet on which he inscribed his intelligence, Caesar was informed of the preparations made for the defense of the place. When he had read the inscription, those who were employed to throw the bullet returning to the city, two Lusitanian brothers deserted and informed us that Pompey in a speech made to his soldiers had said that as he found it impossible to relieve the town, he was resolved to withdraw in the night from the sight of the enemy and retire toward the sea, to which one answered that it was better to hazard a battle than take refuge in flight, but he who said so was instantly put to death.
Damn. Mm. Yeah.
But
everybody's getting touchy. Touchy.
Yeah. At the same time, a Spanish legionary soldier deserting to our camp informed us that Pompey had assembled the people of Acubus and given them instructions to inquire diligently who favored his party and who that to the enemy. Sometime after in the town which was taken, the slave, who, as we have related above, had murdered his master, was apprehended in a mine and burned alive.
Damn.
About the same time, 8 Spanish centurions came over to Caesar, and in a skirmish between our cavalry and that of the enemy, we were repulsed and some of our light-armed foot wounded. The same night we took the enemy's spies, 3 slaves and 1 Spanish soldier. The slaves were crucified and the soldier was beheaded.
I'm sorry, I have to stop right there. Okay, crucifixion, ouch. Painful, I get that. But I'm not going to thank you. Oh, thank you for only cutting my head off, which has got to hurt, versus being crucified. So I guess that's what you do for a citizen versus a slave. Is that the,
it comes
for lack of a better word, honor?
Yeah, yay for being a citizen. It comes with benefits. You don't get crucified, you get beheaded. That's one of the things that you get.
Citizenship.
When you get your citizen membership card, you're reading the benefits. You get 10% off at Starbucks. You get one free night with every 4 nights you book at a leading hotel chain.
Right.
And if you get captured by the enemy, you don't get crucified. You just get beheaded.
Aw. Because it's got the word crucifixion with a circle and a line through it. This will not happen to you, I promise.
It's a picture of a guy on a cross with a line through it. Yeah. You go, oh, shit, I didn't know that. That's a good deal.
Let me whip out my card here.
Jesus should have had one of those. That was his problem. He didn't have that card. When the Roman soldiers arrested Caesar, they say, "Do you have your citizen card on you?" Shit, I left it in my other toga. Other loincloth. Well, can I go back again? No, sorry. You got to carry it on you at all times. That's the rules. I can send one of my guys. No, you guys have run off. They deserted you. Fucking Judases.
No, technically, wasn't everybody in the area at that time Roman citizens? Does that come later? I can't remember my history. Yeah. But anyway,
well, we'll do that when we get to the history of Christianity
podcast series. We'll cover it.
We'll cover that.
Woo! Okay.
Now, the commentaries goes on. Two Spanish legionaries who pretended to be slaves were made prisoners by a party of our horse. But being brought to the camp, they were known by the soldiers who had formerly served under Fabius and Petreius and deserted from Trebonius. No pardon was extended to them, and they were slaughtered by our troops. At the same time, some couriers sent from Corduba to Pompey entered our camp by mistake, were seized, had their hands cut off, and then were dismissed.
Okay, we have to reenact this. Okay, I'm the courier. I come in, the wrong guy. I've got the wrong mail pouch on. You cut off my hands, and then you say, leave. And I'll be like, I can't open the gate. You cut off my hands.
How do I ride a horse without hands? How do I hold on?
How am I supposed to work
Not
now?
My problem, sonny. Clench your
piss
buttocks.
Piss off or cut your feet, yeah.
Really tight.
So they cut off their hands and dismissed them.
Yeah.
That hurts.
That hurts. Maybe they weren't on horse. Maybe they were walking couriers.
Yeah.
Anyway, just to wrap up, Gnaeus retreats. Caesar follows. And the enemy camps near the town of Munda.
Mm-hmm.
About 6 miles away from the town of Urso, where Caesar is. And I think that's where we're going to finish this episode, Ray. We will pick up in episode 41 with the Battle of Munda, the concluding battle of the Civil War.
Don't dare think about not coming back. If you don't, we will cut something off and dismiss you.
We didn't even play any songs in that episode. I think that's the first podcast without... I should put a song in just for the hell of it.
Yeah, find something. Yeah, yeah. What kind of songs? You got all the battle. You got betrayal. You've got torture.
Yeah. Well, this is a song I wanted. I've been looking for an excuse to play. I'll just kick it in here, man. Just cause. Because there's a lot of blood in this episode.
Yeah.
DC.
All right. Talking about blood. Yeah.
I'll talk to you in several weeks, my friend.
Ciao, bella.